What's up? Welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I have Matt Tanter. He's the CSO, Chief Strategy Officer of Grey over in London, and also the chair of the APG, the Account Planning Group, which is, I guess, right, Matt, the main planning institution, organization in the world, pushing all good things to planners about planning and to the world. Welcome, Matt.
Hello. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. There's so much stuff that we can cover. I was involved with the APG back in Australia, great organization. And, you know, I think the thing that we're going to talk about largely today is going to be culture of planning. And, you know, when I do these interviews, I often have types of people in mind. And I know that things like personas are loved by some people and hated by others, but I do often do have certain faces and people in mind. And the person in mind that I have for this conversation is largely someone who is kind of new to the idea of planning and might even be in an agency where planning doesn't exist. And maybe they've lost a few pitches and they start to get feedback that the strategy slash planning, and I use those words interchangeably, especially in America, and they might have had feedback that the strategy or planning wasn't that strong, and deep down they know they went in with 50 slides of statistics, possibly labeled insights, and then had 50 slides of tactics, not necessarily an idea or platform in the middle. And I'll speak to them and I'll be like, yeah, we're trying to work out how to do planning. And one of the first things I will try to understand from them is what is their culture? What is their workflow? Because it's very hard just to drop a planner or planning into an organization, because organizations are very slow to change. So today we're going to hear from a CSO about how it works in a place where it does work. And then we'll try to consider how to get it to work in a place where it has never been. Matt, you're, from what I understand, quite interested in the idea of culture over process with planning, right?
Big believer in, I mean, I've always been very lucky in the agencies I've worked at to work in, an established planning culture, strategy culture within an agency that respects and values strategy and planning greatly. So I've always been lucky enough to be a part of that, and at Grey I've been lucky enough to lead a department and agency and help foster that. So it was at Grey when the brilliant Lucy Jameson sort of talked about Peter Drucker's the power of culture over process, and how culture eats strategy for breakfast, you know, and you can mimic process, mimic product and many things, but your culture is irreplicable and it's a real powerful asset to a company. And I've always been a big believer of the community and the cultural entity of planners, and as part of a broader agency culture, working together to get to great work. So yeah, very passionate about that, and the APG as a community is a natural extension of that for me.
I want to get into the two words. You know, I'm going to do this. What is culture?
Oh, culture, I guess, is a manifestation of beliefs through behaviors, right? It's a set of behaviors which define a belief system and a way of living and shared ideology. I think it's about identity. It's about it's about shared beliefs and ambitions and a shared set of values which unite you as a group together, and it's created by the manifestation of behaviors of people of status and leadership within that community, and it's something you have to work at and nurture and respect, and when you do so you can achieve quite incredible, brilliant things.
Yeah, I mean, culture gets used in various ways, but I think in the way that we're talking about it, it's a set of beliefs that lead to a set of behaviors. So step one, if you're in the world of trying to work out how to improve planning in your agency or get it in the first place, I think, is to get a piece of paper and write beliefs on one part of that piece of paper, behaviors on the other. And in a non-judgmental but slightly compassionate way, just write down what you think the beliefs of the people that you're working with are. There will be stated beliefs in most companies and value statements. Most of them are pretty saccharine, but write them down, right? Because you can't just change an entire stack of beliefs by hiring a head of planning, for example. Okay, what about the word process?
I was lucky enough when I started as a planner to be sort of fed an incredible stack of books and thinking by various people. And one of them that I still haven't read in a while, but I'm going to go back to is, I don't know if you've read it, Tom Peters' Reimagine, which was one of the most incredible sort of rants and raves about modern business culture. And in there, I remember a phrase that jumped out. He said, you need enough process so you don't need process, you know. And I'm not saying process per se is a bad thing, but the culture and sense of identity and shared ambition should always lead for me, and then you need enough flexibility in the steps and process and guidelines upon which you go through things. Frameworks as springboards rather than handcuffs, ways of operating workflow. And different clients will have different processes. That's what I think is interesting, is when agencies become too structured in their own process, then it dictates how you operate with clients who may have very different, varying needs and their own ways of thinking. So yeah. I'm not banging out and saying it's unnecessary. It's just always slightly dubious about having the exact way of how you should answer a problem before you've even truly sat down and engaged and gone through the initial process.
Yeah, and I don't know, there's probably academic language, there's probably an adjective or two that goes in front of the word process in some places, because you have conventional, traditional processes like the 5 D's. So yeah. I'm not talking at you, Matt, I'm talking to people who are listening. But like, you know, so
discovery.
So there's, you know, I guess you could call it like a light process, like the 5 D's. Discovery, definition of problem and need, design, development, deployment. That was one that I grew up around. With planning, you know, write a discussion guide, work out what you're trying to do, talk to people, define the problem, what's the insight, what's the strategy, right? So these are kind of like process light. And I know I talk about America. I love the USA, guys, but you know, I had some weird experiences here. So I talk about it because I had huge business culture shock. Then there's the other side of that, which is someone trying to write almost like a 60-step guide to getting to an idea. Like, where does Gray sit on that?
The complete other end of the spectrum, you know, complete other end of the spectrum, which is much more about a shared ambition at the start of a project, understanding the problem that you face and a shared ambition of where the outcome that you want to achieve or the trajectory and that outcome, and then working through a much lighter touch process of then how you go about achieving that. You know, we use simple frameworks, as you'd expect, from a brief construct of, you know, issue, insight, idea, and how the impact you want to have, or the classic 4-box matrix of understanding the consumer insight, the cultural tension, the category opportunity, and the company's right to play. Many of which I'm sure many agencies, the big agencies, will play around. Which is why it's the way in which you leap from that and how you work together, which can create something distinctive in the face of other agencies who will have the same process. You know, process is going to be very similar in lots of different agencies, but the culture of how you attack that and the energy you take into that is what will set you apart. And that's what clients feel when they're in the room.
Yeah, well, the irony of all of this, I'm not sure if it was in a book called, it was a book on talent. Talent is overrated, overrated or grit. And the researchers were saying that the longer that someone's doing something, the top people in that field have very, very simple rules of thumb. It could be three or four or five beliefs or principles that they apply, but because of their experience and because of their technical ability, they apply these things in very specific and powerful ways, so that someone who's been designing for 20 to 25 years, who's incredible, if one of their principles is take away everything I don't need, like that's kind of part of their process, you know, because part of their process will be have a bunch of ideas, make a bunch of stuff, take away everything I don't need.
And I totally agree. In fact, I was only talking the other day to one of our very brilliant global planning partners here at Gray, who was talking just at that and saying, as the more senior he gets and with the more senior clients he is working with, the simpler his approaches and frameworks have become in order to be able to clearly land and operationalize his thinking. So it's not only just out of repetition and habit and themes, but also out of the need that when you get to that level, you need to be able to land it so simply. And that takes a lot of simplification versus simplicity, as you will know, is two different things. It takes a lot of effort to make it that simple, and that's something you just have to work on. I think the interesting thing you touch upon is, though, to many people listening, I'm sure, that the notion of it for 25 years doing the same thing and applying the same logic day in, day out on is an interesting one. You know, we're working with talent, and I myself have come through many different types of agencies tackling different types of problems in different ways. So the thought of pure repetition of the same approach is not something that sits totally comfortably with me, and indeed many of the other younger strategists, I'm sure, coming out. So it's going to be interesting how people having frameworks they can draw upon and pull upon to shortcut and to tackle problems, which you yourself provide brilliantly, are really useful ways to allow you to tackle problems.
Yeah, and so that's not to say that those rules of thumb are something that someone's repeating robotically for 20 to 25 years, but they're able to apply them in a more specific way, knowing that there's going to be chaos in all creative work, as there needs to be.
Yeah.
So, but I also think that planners, or anyone who's doing creative work or thinking work, they need to, and I see people debate this idea. I think they need to be able to express themselves on a project. Mm-hmm. And then some people will say, oh no, you're there to do the client's work, and it's, you know, that's being disobedient and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you have a strong opinion about the idea of self-expressing on a project?
100% good. I expect it from everyone. I expect brilliant creatives to be brilliant at strategy, strategists to be able to lean heavily into ideas, and client service and business directors to be able to lean into strategy. You know, for me, the it's the melting pot of everyone together, and all the other disciplines on top of that triumvirate and design and technology and data and so forth. It's all about self-expression. To me, that's the magic. That's the gold dust which you want people to bring. And I look for strategists when you hire to understand what expression and personality that planner is going to bring to the project and the business. 100%.
Okay, so let's explicitly get back into the idea of culture. How would you describe the culture of planning at Grey?
Open is how we have always talked about it. An open culture of collaboration, empowerment, diversity of thought. It's about giving people the freedom and autonomy to express themselves and to pursue their trains of thought. It's about a more of a coaching mentality rather than pure sort of hierarchical in terms of management and sign off. And it's one that breeds hopefully an absorption of different stimulus and thinking and generalism in thought that allows work to flourish, be more diverse, but equally creates a more stimulating and enjoyable environment for people to be a part of, and a community for people to be a part of. And I should say that is not something that's just distinct of the planning community. You know, we're not just a subset of standalone. Everything is within the context of the broader agency. That's to your point about people on their own trying to forge a strategic crew and community. You have to be a part of, respected, and part of the broader team, of course.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit more? So if we're talking about culture as being a set of behaviors born from a set of beliefs, is there anything that we haven't talked about that would help us understand the beliefs at the heart of that culture?
I guess it's really hard, right? There's a really simple behavior that I think has been transformative to our planning culture, and you're probably gonna laugh. It's not anything grandiose, but it's something that's really simple, and we do it every week. And it's a Thursday morning breakfast. It's a Thursday morning breakfast where every week we all get together and we talk and we share briefs and we share thinking, and interesting people stand up and the team stands up. And I say it because you can write, to your point, down the big belief statements, but ultimately it's those daily behaviors and rituals which change and create community and identity and change in an organization. And having a forum where week in, week out, the community of 20 or 30 or however many planners sitting down and building relationships and supporting each other and talking can be, you know, serendipitously exchanging thoughts on briefs and problems, can be one of the most powerful galvanizers and catalysts in a team culture. And it's those sort of like, you know, Malcolm Gladwell being talking about breaker windows, the things that give permission for all the other things to happen, that I think are the important things to look for and do. I'm a big lover of both hip hop and creativity. And Questlove was interviewed on his book about creativity. And he had a lovely expression as well, which is like, you know, find your flock. When he was asked about how he would recommend it. And I think we need to create those environments for that crew to come together.
With the breakfast meetings, are there certain things that you're conscious of doing in those meetings? Like for instance, I used to start planning meetings or strategy meetings by asking people, what's one risk you've taken in the past week and how did it go? There were, I don't know, 12 to 15 of us. So there weren't too many people, but it sent a signal that the aim was to take risks and to learn from them and to share.
I guess it's more, we always encourage people to stand up if they're new to the team and present and share something from themselves or something they're passionate about, something that allows them to realize this is a place of growth and vulnerability is okay and good and we're there to support each other. We put briefs on the table to discuss. People share their problems. There aren't. I like that notion of those sort of specific questions around things like that. But no, more just a general team pushing and supporting each other and spilling out into daily life in the agency.
Yeah. So some of the traits that you mentioned before about planning, and then within Grey as well, you're saying in London, are openness, collaboration, diversity, freedom, autonomy, coaching, an appreciation for generalism. And community. And I got to tell you that I think a lot of people who've spent a few years inside a good, productive planning department will relate to that. The problem is when they then try an agency that's not like that and is not used to having planning. You know, I've worked in places, I like coaching. It's probably obvious for the stuff that I do, right? And I've worked in places that are suspicious of that because I felt that there was an expectation that you have to be a boss and boss people around and tell them what to do. And I learned that because sometimes other senior people weren't in the room and I'd ask people their opinions and they would say, just tell me what to do. And I'm like, how are you in this industry and interacting with me like that right now? I've never heard that before. So you must know people who've been very optimistic about establishing new planning departments in agencies that haven't had them, or who've been just a new planner in an agency that's not used to planning. What are some of the cultural barriers that you've heard about when people try to bring in planning, and specifically planning described in the way that you've described it at Grey?
Well, yeah, it's a big question. I guess you've got to interrogate the broader organizational culture before you sort of join or get a sense of it, don't you, to understand what the dominant behaviors of that organization are, what the people with the status and the influence in the organization, how do they feel? You know, sometimes you find that it's agencies which have a very clear sort of mimic and hierarchical approach to the lens of how certain people think the world is and the work is made, and you're there to replicate and be a part of that, which can be good if you're learning as a planning function, but not if it's necessary to form and express and to change. I think if you're starting as a junior or a mid-strat and you're trying to create a strategy function, I worry that that's a really hard ask for strategists without a senior leader of the discipline who has the sponsorship of executive members. That's a really hard uphill task to operate within. I guess it's understanding what you're in for as you enter into those places, and if you're in there, how much are you prepared to take on to try and change it versus looking for a more conducive culture that is embracing and ready for you to step into. So yeah, it is a hard one. Like I said, I've been blessed with planning cultures that are established, and to think that there's a lot of, I guess, junior strategists out there trying to form the very essence of a strategy department within a broader agency is a tough one, because there's a lot of responsibility to take on when a time when you should be really learning as much as anything.
Yeah, I get messages from people who convinced their bosses that they wanted to be a strategist, and they're a year or two into a career and they're not sure exactly what to do with it, and nor is the boss who's never had strategy. And then on the other side, I know senior people, I mean, I've gone through this, who it's very hard to diagnose what a company's like while you're interviewing. I admit, in New York, I got to the point where every agency's got a story, and there's pressure on agencies because margins are getting tighter. So they're all looking at ways of increasing their access to bigger budgets or to not lose their budgets. And planning is a tool that many of them use purely for business development, not necessarily for good thinking. I got to the point where on a few interviews, I was like, you know, can I just want to come in and look over people's shoulders at the work they're doing, because everybody's got a story. And that was, because it's hard to diagnose. I mean, I get so many messages from people who are totally gaslit, where they get brought in as a head of strategy or in a very senior strategy role, and the person who hired them, who's the president or CEO and the management team, they don't want to let them in. They're not going to change anything. It destroys people for years. Do you hear many stories like that in the UK? And I'm not being dramatic. I want to be really clear that I can point. Yeah. If I was on LinkedIn, I can point to tens and tens and tens of people, and they do gather a little bit more in certain types of agencies.
I think that the dominant story we hear over in London, and it is maybe different, is more of huge expectation, responsibility, pressure placed upon junior strategists to deliver in increasingly tough circumstances, rather than I'm not going to let you do your thing. I don't buy what you can deliver. And I'm just going to sort of just take the money from the client for your hours. So the dominant narrative is much more about how do we help both planners that have that incredible energy to propel themselves and their thinking forwards, harness that energy and manage that energy and look after themselves. But equally, how do we champion a culture and a way of working as in the strategy community, which is more conducive, more supportive, more sustainable. And encourages perspective and boundaries rather than takes advantage of the energy and willingness of young minds. So that's more of the story that we see over here in London. But I guess I can imagine in the States and where people strive to set themselves on the path they want to go upon there, it's more about a frustration that they're not able to express themselves or there's not the willingness to change. And I think that's, you have to take it as far as you can take it. Find the people that you think are most likely to make the change, push as hard as you can. But if there's a point where you go, do you know what, my energy is just being absolutely depleted and there's no momentum, then you have to make the switch, I would say.
When you talk about tough circumstances, what are you hearing?
Where do you start? That there's impossible expectations on people being put in positions where they are being asked to do more senior, more, a greater quantity of work, under greater duress, without the support, remuneration and respect of the broader culture, and management and leadership, that it's taking its toll physically, obviously mentally, from a confidence point of view, that people are simply not having the time to do the work in the way they'd like. A lack of boundaries that people are putting onto a younger planners, and that therefore planners are also, the lack of boundaries planners are placing on themselves is quite crazy. Even in a well-intentioned culture and organization, that is, it is still a really hard task to balance the needs of clients, the commercial needs of the organization, the talent development, resilience and energy. It's even with the best intentions, it's really hard to manage. And in organizations where they're much more commercially focused and understandably under pressure at these times, then there's a human capital, unfortunately, and that is playing out. We see it quite prevalently at a mid and senior strategic level.
Do you have any suggestions for how someone can, first of all, diagnose whether the impossible expectations they're feeling are legitimate or just part of growing pains, and then what to do about them?
Well, I think the first thing, I mean, the brilliant Kat Wiles, who's the head of strategy at BCCP, yesterday at an APG event, talked so eloquently and brilliantly on this subject. And one of the things she says is, you know, set reasonable expectations of yourself. I'm not saying don't push yourself and have a growth mindset and look to succeed, but be reasonable about the expectations you're placing on yourself and not beating yourself up horrendously for not being able to deliver to a boss's expectation or what you're seeing at the end of the world around you. So I think understanding what's a realistic expectation of yourself and understanding what you need. I always say to my team, manage up, push on to your senior management to support you, to provide you with the prioritization, to provide you with the resources, to provide you with the guidance to be able to fulfill and on the opportunities that you have. Those are the sorts of proactive steps that a planner can take in order to change and take control of the situation. But equally, the onus is on the management to create an environment and a culture where that is encouraged and expected.
Yeah, I think there need to be way more senior voices in public talking about these topics, because when you're feeling these things, it's very lonely. And then when the industry's quiet, you're just like, well, maybe that's just the way it is. And that's not going to breed a healthy industry. For what it's worth, for those listening, I think, again, there's a whole typology of impossible expectations that we could get into. Because on the one hand, you're going to have clients launching a campaign on Friday night at a big event. And we, you know, you're going to have to work the whole weekend getting some report together. That's for you to decide if that's an impossible expectation. But one thing that I personally started to do is just simplify questions I was asking myself. So what's one risk I could take on this project? What's one thing I could do differently? What's one thing I learned from last project? And using numbers like that to give me a sense of focus and power and calm through what will be chaos. Do you have any techniques like that?
No, I mean, the thing, and I'll be happy to admit that I apply it, is catching yourself. You know, the way in which we think and operate under duress is learned through years of habitual behavior and response to situations, you know, fight or flight and so forth. And in situations when you're finding yourself going down a path of stress, distress, if you can just stop and observe that that is happening, catch yourself in that moment and just take a second, 20 seconds, whatever it might be, to catch yourself and observe what response is likely to come as a result, you know, of your, and observe that, step back and be able to catch yourself. That can at least allow you the moment of awareness to then go, okay, now how do I want to actually change this? What do I want to get out of this? What would be a better way, more useful and helpful way for me to respond? So catching yourself at those moments is key, and I've certainly found useful for me. And like you say, taking control and realizing this is your day, this is your life. Get out of it what you want, and beginning to set your own priorities, as you said, is critical. So yeah,
I sometimes have a few mantras. I always imagine people in London in planning rolling their eyes when I use a word like that. But there's Parkinson's law, I think it's Parkinson's law, that we'll take the time we have. It's very trite, but it's kind of calming. And then I love just thinking about what is reality. You know, we're making it all up. So why don't I try to make my own reality on this project?
No, I was going to say one that I always have, and I got it from working with Nils Leonard closely when he was here for a few years. You know, we used to say, you'd see it, groups of people around a table and they'd be furrowed brows and screwing their hands about trying to solve a problem. You see them there one day and you see them there the next day. And we always used to say levity, not pressure.
You know? Yeah.
Levity, not pressure.
A light heart.
The increased amount of pressure that you place upon yourself because of your passion, because of your desire for perfectionism, creates a paralysis and a moment of levity, a moment of puncturing that, which seems totally counterintuitive to want to make people laugh, to want to make people, you know, can actually then create a breakthrough and a perspective which can breed a more enjoyable, but ultimately better work. So one I always have is that levity, not pressure.
It'd be interesting seeing agencies put up laughter monitoring things in as part of their balanced scorecard. You mentioned the phrase manage up. Now, I've heard that a bunch of times as well. And I've heard it from people who were never in the agency. I've heard it from people who would also say, only bring me the solution, not the problem, which when you're starting out is a bit of a riddle.
Yeah.
What is an appropriate use of managing up?
And what I mean is, like, it sounds a really structured term. For me, it's about a member of the team being comfortable and comfortable enough more than anything, with a relationship with their senior line manager, to talk to them, to ask them to clarify what they expect, the priorities that they expect, to share their work earlier rather than later, to embrace opinion, and to begin to get them on a point of trajectory of the way they're working, with the right support and resources and time expectations they need in order to do their job to the best of their ability and to benefit And that's what I mean by managing up. You're not, there's a sense of through fear and desire to do the best job, you hold on too tight to the project you have, or and you leave it until that, you know, the deadline's 2 weeks, and you leave it until the moment of engaging with your boss to the day before those 2 weeks because you need to get it perfect, rather than a more open, and it puts more responsibility on the manager. It asks of them to support, to help, and it creates a much more supportive relationship. You know, I've always thought that and I say it to the people in my team who are managing younger people, you learn more about yourself from the people you manage than you will from the people above you. You will learn more about how you behave and your own weaknesses and your own strengths from people that are asking questions and asking of you. So it's a real two-way thing, I think. But yeah, managing up and opening yourself up in that sense is what I mean.
I'm getting flashbacks to when I first heard it. And it was one of those words which, when I look back at it now, kind of shocked me a bit, because I was in a place that was doing pretty good work. It was pretty loosey-goosey. You know, in Australia, people go to work in thongs or flip-flops, and everyone knows that, right? The difference there. And then someone said this phrase, and I was like, God, why are you using business speak? I thought we're doing...
Yeah, I know. I feel like I kind of cringe when I say it, but I don't know.
Because, and I think the phrase, it changed. I was like, oh God, now I've got to act all businessy with this person in an agency that doesn't really act like that. What's a different phrase? I think we need to change it.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You're right. You know, and as I think you're right. I don't know. I'll think about that. I'll drop you an email for a better one. But you're right. It doesn't quite sit right with me. But it's the best way of. I think people. I guess what I'm getting at is it's about taking control of your situation rather than the management coming down. It's about you feeling empowered and in control to be able to manage the people, above you to help you. That's what I've always liked about it, because it's important. It puts as much of this is about a nurturing environment for junior people. It's also about saying, hey, there is a certain amount of responsibility that you need to grasp in order to change your own trajectory and future. And we're going to give you that responsibility, and you have to take it, and you will make with it what you will, and we will help you. And that's what I loved about running a department, is being able to help people do that and expecting them to lean into it and take it.
So in behavioral economics, there's this idea of deliberate practice. And deliberate practice is where you break down the key components of your craft and you try to practice the most difficult parts of them in a live situation, and you get feedback, right? So if you wanted mm-hmm. to get good at, mm-hmm. shooting three pointers in basketball, mm-hmm. you'd probably set a number. I'm going to do 200. I'm going to shoot 200 times today. I'm going to have people running at me in random ways. Someone's going to pass me the ball. I'm going to have a coach monitoring me, giving me feedback. As far as like writing creative briefs, do you give mm-hmm. feedback? Rate and review briefs every 3 to 6 months? You know, what are the feedback mechanisms that you've seen that are useful specifically around creative briefs?
You know, planning is not a vacuum for a start. So, you know, immediately understanding your relationship with other members of the team, I think it starts there, not even with my feedback on a brief, but how the team collectively have agreed an ambition and approach and what they want. That's the first thing for me. I tend to sit in an exploratory phase with people on briefs as they're kicking out into different options. Like I always find if you're approaching a senior member of either the planning or the creative department, or even to show them your brief, you know, I always feel the first point of contact, you've got to recognize this as a thinker who is going to be thinking expansively about the problem, and therefore to give them one singular option is going to be it's going to be tricky. So I always think you start with it's good to start with an expansive conversation around the different ways into it. And then more recently, we've got more specific on the craft of a brief and the sacrifice that you need to put into writing a brief, the how tight, you know, the narrative flows. And that's something more recently we're again just going back to ensuring that as you get new members into the team in, and as you need to just revisit together and push on. But it's much more about supporting people as they define the problems, supporting them as they expansively look at different options, and then being there to help them craft and push the briefs as they then critically write them. But it's fair to say as well, you know, we've got a number of very senior planning partners who act as a sort of distributed leadership that mentor and drive and push the briefs. And each of them have their own style and their own beliefs and their own way of operating. So it creates a, rather than just going through one uniform approach that one head of strata, one CSO believes in, it's about making sure we have the nuances and the flavors of different strategy teams.
Okay.
If that answers your question.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I mean, what I'm hearing is that there's feedback in the form of in-project application of domain expertise, experience, and technical craft skills and subjectivity. So I get that. It's maybe not as formalized as I think some of the deliberate practice.
No, definitely. You know, part of the open culture we talked about with strategy is to create teams that are empowered and are given their opportunity for self-expression to take their thinking in the way that they feel is best appropriate to solve the problem with their clients, support them with line management that can guide them and push them, but not to create a singular funnel through me as a CSO that says this is the way I would do it. Because if you're looking for diversity of thought, if you're looking for different innovative ways of solving problems, you want to try and create an environment which allows for those varying approaches while still holding, I guess, a standard.
Yeah, and I think that's just the application of those beliefs you mentioned earlier, openness, collaboration, diversity, etc. I ran a day for digital agencies exploring strategy recently, and I started to write down like this kind of operating system, because often people think about planning and they think about the brief, and that risks there being too much of a sacredness around the brief. And I do think you've got to zoom back out and actually think about, like, does this agency actually have a philosophy, a creative philosophy, a planning philosophy? How do those things sit together? And then there's a bunch of other things you need to think through before you even get to the small things, such as the brief. Like, what's the philosophy of Gray?
We've always talked about a cultural ambition in our work. The work, we don't have a house style of work. We've always been very proud of the fact that we don't necessarily have a house style. We have a house standard, but we try and adhere to. But we've always, you know, the guiding philosophy that's pushed us forward for the last few years is about asking ourselves a question of what's the cultural ambition of this project, what's the cultural ambition for this brand, where can we take it, where, what's the outcome that we want to achieve, and then how can we best achieve that through the thinking and through the work. And it's led to work of different shapes and different types of output with that outcome in mind rather than necessarily the singular form of whether it's advertising or communication to solve a problem. And then as part of that, obviously, therefore, a strategic approach to understand people in the wider context, cultural tensions, and that kind of approach in terms of strategy and really the role of the planner in being the arbiter and the person facilitating and keeping people true to, right, this is a trajectory we're on, this is where we want to take the brand, take the work. It's been how we've adopted it, and equally we've got, you know, different clients and different ways of approaching it. But that's been the approach that has guided us. And like I say, it's a spirit, and it's a sort of a combination of a belief in the type of work we want to make, and with open how we want to work to create it.
So you've talked about cultural ambition and shared ambition a few times now. Can you give me an example pointing at a particular project? How do you write that? What kinds of words are you using to each other or on a piece of paper?
I think it varies, right? So it's like, it's with Lucozade Sport, one of our brands, it's like, how do we get a million people moving? How do we move you from a competitive brand that's about football and rugby and into actually a modern fitness culture and get a million people around the country moving and active, right? With Volvo, they almost have their own ambition, which is, you know, by 2020, no one in or because of a Volvo should die in an accident. And that created a real sense of a cultural vision and ambition, all the work around it that we wanted to make. And it can be more executional, you know, it can be more with the Vinnie Jones work we did, you know, a number of years ago. It was about how we created entertainment and educate people through entertainment with the likes of likes of Vinnie Jones or shows, theatre shows. So it can be like, I guess, more brand purpose level ambition in the world versus more for the execution and how you take out into culture and how you're going to get into popular culture with the executional construct. So it works in different ways, and thinking about it kind of helps us in terms of, you know, classic cutting through the expectation. People don't care. They're not thinking about our brands. They're not thinking about the work that we create. So we have to do our best to puncture that and be a part of that.
Yeah. And I think, again, to go back to the very start of this, that anyone thinking about bringing in planning into an agency, just from what we talked about there, what Matt was talking about, there's a set of beliefs, right? Which is to be provocative. We believe in being provocative. We believe in work that makes a difference to people in culture, in public. We set high expectations, right? So you could probably list 30 to 40 beliefs just from what Matt's been talking about today. Let me go on to the last topic. And I know we've touched on this as well. We have jumped around a bit. That's always my fault. You've recently had a night at the APG, the Account Planning Group, in London, talking about mental health. Can you talk to me about why now for that topic, and what were some of the conversations that happened on the night?
As I've talked endlessly with you already about the importance of community. When I joined the APG, I said to Sarah Newman, the brilliant director of the APG, the most important letter in it is, for me, is the G, is the group, and how we support each other, how outside of the pressures and competitiveness of agency culture and holding companies and so forth, we can support each other. So it's always been clear to me that there is a rising issue with specifically people's mental health and varying degrees of people losing confidence to the more clinical aspect of mental health. It's always been clear that that's an issue, and we wanted to do something about that. We carried out a survey initially last year to get a sense of it amongst the strategic community, and we're really quite taken aback about how prevalent the problem that we sort of anecdotally thought would be a problem was. And then we held an event. We're very careful that we are not positioning ourselves as any kind of an organization trying to present problems to clinical solutions to clinical problems. We wanted to just start with a conversation in a informal environment to air the topic with people who were interested. And we had a great response and a great turnout. We had three people talking. Paul Phillips, who is an account manager, works all in different parts of the world, talked brilliantly about how the brain structure of the prefrontal cortex, the limbic system, and the relationship between the two, and how we as planners, obviously, are the prefrontal cortex is the aspect of our brain that really develops a conscious thought, but it's the limbic system which fires off all those wonderful hormones and neurotransmitters which result in a more evolutionary side of our brain about flight and fear that we all know so well, and that kicks in. And he explained brilliantly about the nature of understanding when your limbic system is firing, and when we all wake up at 4 a.m. there's a reason why we're having nervous and anxious thoughts, and that's because our prefrontal cortex is fast asleep and our limbic system is firing. And you know how you can recognize that and understand that and understand the brain traps of the way that plays. And that really gave us a sense that, you know, thinking can get us into, as a group of planners who are addicted to thinking, to solve problems, that addiction to thinking can turn on ourselves and cause ourselves problems. But yet we can use that same application of thought to outmaneuver our brain and think differently and recognize when you're behaving in certain ways and to recognize what to absorb. So he talked brilliantly about that. We had another speaker called Richard, who spoke about his experience as a city lawyer who had everything going for him, family, work, success, and his experience one day where it all fell apart and he had a breakdown. He's written a brilliant book about his experience and how that, you know, seemingly he would never have put himself as that person. Over five or so years, it built up and built up until one day he got out of his car south of Paris with his family in the car and walked across three lanes of traffic until someone stopped and asked him what he was doing. And he spoke brilliantly about the recognition that we all must have about this is not an issue that is abnormal. It's strong, good people who suffer from breakdown and depression and how it can creep up and creep up. And at one moment, a seemingly insignificant thing can, as he says, make your bucket overflow, and you need to recognize that. So he talked brilliantly about techniques for how you can make your bucket of resilience bigger, how you can take things out of it, recognize what you're putting into it as an analogy for dealing with mental health. And he's now part of an organization which is trying to create better cultures, certainly within the legal sector, for resilience. And then Kat Wiles, who's the head of strategy at BCCP, spoke incredibly honestly, truthfully, intimately to the crew about her personal experience, which was quite extraordinary, actually. It was very touching, and I won't go into it on here, but she was at pains to point out, she read brilliantly from a book which says, you know, the people that suffer from bouts of depression and mental illness are by their very nature people with strength, with generosity, who take more upon their shoulders than others, who seek to help others more than themselves, who can be relied upon, who are turned to, and in so doing, inevitably, take too much on and ask themselves to do too much. And it's in that behavior that brings the problems with it. So it is an issue of strength, not of weakness. She talked brilliantly and eloquently, and it was really, and the response has been fantastic. And for us, it's the very start. We now can see the level of response we've had. We want it to be the start of many more conversations and initiatives, and how we as a committee and a group of strategists can take responsibility for workplace conduct, culture, hold ourselves to account as a crew, the senior strategists, to try and not only help create the coping mechanisms for people in situations like that, but more importantly, create cultures which don't allow that to be necessary. I think that's the aim of it.
Yeah, and I'm like 25 years into my superpower, which is feeling sadness and melancholy very easily. And there are various reasons from growing up and all sorts of things. And I follow the space quite a lot. But the trite sentence, or the trite realization that it's not just me, is incredibly powerful, because often in our small lives, we think it is just us. And sometimes we live with people, we grow up with people who make it out to be unusual because we feel like that. And they say things like, well, I've never felt like that, which means that you're broken. And I think that whole idea of being broken in this is not useful, as opposed to trying to find the strength in what you're feeling, and knowing that you're not alone, and also knowing that it can be very, very complicated and down to a very specific individual level. So it's good to hear that the APG is doing that kind of stuff. Yeah. Do you want to give us a really quick update on what the APG is up to?
So there's absolutely loads and loads going on. There's sort of a few key pillars to what the APG does. Firstly, you know, a huge amount of training. We're a massive resource for training, and we are trying to make it as affordable and accessible for strategists at all levels to access training from brilliant thought leaders and senior strategists from London. It's mostly delivered through the London UK. So apologies to people in the States, but we try and film as much of the stuff that we do. So if you want to be a member and access, but we are looking to think how we expand it out. So huge amount of training programs, and the theme for training this year that we're really getting into is putting the people back into planning. So how we can help the strategic community fall in love once again with people through empathy and understanding of culture and behavior and so forth. So there's going to be a series of events going on this year, and there's a huge wealth of training and workshops and areas of expertise. Another area is around inspiration. So noisy thinking is a big thing we do, and themes that help people get tackle the barriers facing them getting to better and more creative work. But the big bit this year is it's every 2 years we have the Creative Strategy Awards. So the Creative Strategy Awards have been running for 25 years now, every 2 years, and is a celebration and recognition of the best creative thinking, strategy, and work on the planet. So whilst the IPA brilliantly gives you the story of the effectiveness and the journey, this is the creative strategy of how it's been made. Brilliant essays written and presentations given, and Jim Carroll's chairing the final round of judges, which will be phenomenal. And Vicky Holgate is chairing the shortlisters. And normally there's a theme every 2 years. So last couple of years ago it was transformation. A couple of years before that was influence. But this year, Sarah and I sat down and we thought there is no better theme than the right now, with everything going on and the value that needs to be placed on pure creativity of thought. So we've stripped, for the 25th year, stripped away the theme, and it is just the APG Creative Strategy Awards in its purity, allowing people to bring whatever form and agenda they feel is most powerful to their papers. So that's open now. The deadline is, I believe, the 4th of April. So if you're interested, it's a chance to get your paper read by the leading strategists from London around the world. And we would love people to get involved.
Awesome. And anyone who's new or not even new to a career, I think just spending a lot of time with those case studies and papers, and not just reading them, but analyzing them. Like, taking notes and looking, creating your own typology. Like, what are people saying? How are they doing it? There's definitely a subgenre of writing in some of these award entries, which is kind of funny.
Lyricism, as Vicky called it the other day, which I like. The lyricism. But on a serious note, the two aspects to these Creative Strategy Awards are key to being a strategist. So the first, the articulation. And the story at the heart of your strategy, and then the second part, if you're lucky enough to make it through, the ability to stand up, to present, to respond to questions, to persuade, to argue. So it's really kind of one of a kind, and it's great to be. And like you say, if there's one thing you can do out there as a strategist, if you are, as you say, Mark, on your own in an organization trying to further your discipline, get onto the APG. There's a thing called the Think Tank where we've made every paper, over 200 papers available for you to be able to access if it as a member, or if you can get onto WARC and every day just read one of those papers. It's got every story from Dove, Try Something New Today, from Sainsbury's, from Honda, Hate Something. It's got iconic, brilliant stories of strategic awesomeness. And if there's a pep up read in the morning, that's sure as hell is one of those papers.
Awesome. All right. Well, we did jump through a lot of topics, but I think most of them can really come back to culture and helping people understand the beliefs and the behaviors that drive good planning. You know, and I think even just talking about mental health, there's a behavior in there that comes from a belief that not expecting people to turn themselves off at work or not creating due rest through work is something that a planning leader needs to be aware of. And if they're not, you know, go somewhere else. I'm joking. Matt, where are you most active on the internet?
I guess probably Twitter. I've got a bit of a love-hate relationship with Twitter. I sort of go for it and then I step back because of all the sort of fierce debate and competition. But Twitter at Matt Tanta is where I'm at. Probably best to catch me.
You can always find a happy place on Twitter. All right, Matt. Thank you so much for joining us today on Sweathead.
Pleasure. Cheers, mate. Bye-bye. Thanks.